Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Kerr Hallenbeck. I'm going to begin this program today with a reflection on an interaction with the homeless in New York City. This from The Saint's Guide to Relationships, Volume 3. It takes place on Christmas Eve in Manhattan. I emerge from the apartment of a colleague hosting a holiday party with a Charles Dickens theme. After reading from A Christmas Carol and imbibing a hot holiday punch, I step outside onto a snowy, silent street on the east side, a street where I can still see the remnants of the bygone Victorian era in the architecture, especially tonight, a quiet, carless night. I pull up my wool collar around my neck and begin my walk toward the Fifth Avenue train station. On one of the street corners, a grocery store is still open with a display of Christmas bouquets outside in the falling snow. There are red roses, pink, white, all wrapped for Christmas with evergreen and holiday ribbon. I buy the white roses and continue toward the train. Along the way are some of the most affluent properties in the city, perhaps the world. Still in my mid-20s, I don't have very much. I have no life partner or child or country getaway yet, but I do have a sweet apartment, a good job, and loving friends. And so I feel rich and grateful in the way that city girls do, with my whole life ahead of me, sparkling in the new snow. I cross Madison Avenue, still heading west, and begin the walk alongside Trump Tower. On the Madison Avenue side of the building is something wonderful, a huge glass atrium with a bamboo garden inside, an excellent place to take a break or have lunch or meet a friend. Tonight, it is open, a shelter to the homeless. As I walk, I look through the tremendous glass windows and see all kinds of people resting on the benches, having something to eat, clinging together on Christmas Eve. Four homeless people, one woman and three men, sit around a table playing cards among deli cups of coffee and old stained parkas. The woman is in her late 40s, brown hair streaked with gray. I walk past the entrance door, and I slow down. I turn around and peer inside again. I open the door. Entering the garden, I walk slowly to the woman. Gently, I hand her my bouquet of roses and say, "Merry Christmas." She takes them and stares at the ivory velvet blossoms, speechless. Finally, a gentleman friend speaks for her, putting down his cards. "You couldn't have given them to a nicer girl." And we smile. The anonymous woman helps me to understand that the gift of the white rose is to give it away, not to hold it, striving instead to become the rose itself. And there is no place, no better place, to give away the sacred than Metropolis, a place where strangers cross barriers and boundaries each day, stepping out of life and character to greet each other on diverse, alternative, merciful, and sometimes exalted planes of existence. Today on the Godspeed Institute, we welcome Mayor Honan, UCC minister and co-founder of Grace Street Ministry, a compassionate outreach ministry to the homeless and marginalized in downtown Portland, Maine, offering support through presence, prayer, and advocacy. Mayor, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for asking me to share with you.
Now, of course, when we think of the homeless, as I just shared a story from New York City, we tend to think of the larger cities in America. But I imagine in view of the economic crisis of recent years, this might be a more widespread concern. And your ministry is in Portland, Maine. Mm-hmm. And can you share a little bit of what is your ministry? What is your church?
Mm-hmm. Well, we started about 6 years ago. Two of us, two UCC ministers, felt that we wanted to see if the folks that were homeless could use a pastor, basically. We thought they could, but, you know, do-gooders in general think things maybe that are not always true.
Not always wanted.
Yeah, exactly. So what we did basically was just to try to find out if that was true. And that means spending time with people that are homeless, walking where they are, you know, sitting, visiting with them. And it took a while, but definitely we found out that the presence of a pastoral presence was really something very appreciated. And so what we do is we walk around downtown Portland on certain days. We have a kind of a semi-schedule so people know where we are. We go in and out of shelters around the same time each week. We have a short prayer and communion. I just came from this morning. It's 11:30 on the sidewalk outside a soup kitchen.
Mm.
And basically, we're there to try to remember a bigger picture, maybe to bring a bit of hope. We do a lot of listening, and it's a lot of one-to-one ministry. In other words, if you're walking along and, you know, you see somebody and their pants are ripped or dirty, you might just in the conversation say, you know, could you use a new pair of jeans? And then we go get the jeans and try to meet them another day with the jeans or the sneakers or whatever seems that could be, you know, helpful to them. It's a very simple ministry. I mean, I just know that anybody could do this, basically. I've had interns with me over the last few years in and out, and sometimes they start thinking, oh, my God, I can't do this, you know. And I think by the end of the independent study or the internship that they do, they realize that it's really about accepting people that maybe previously you were afraid of, or you thought they were dirty, or you just hadn't, you know, extended yourself to find out who they were.
Yeah.
And once you do that, you really find out they're on some level, they're your family. I mean, that's what I think really happens.
Thank you. You say on the on your website that part of your mission is to decrease the, quote, the imagined and real boundaries between those who have little materially and those who have much.
Right.
Can, you know, in a large city as something like New York, people tend to be very verbal and open in your, you know, and there's a lot of more walking going around.
Mm-hmm.
There's much less driving,
mm-hmm.
you know, for people who live in the city. So you tend to encounter folks in a more direct way.
Right.
Pretty often. Can you share about these imagined and real boundaries? What are the real boundaries you perceive after these years?
Yeah, well, I think the reality is that people that have, and this is changing somewhat. I mean, it is changing. There are more middle class falling into the rabbit hole and having really harsh times. But I think in general, you know, a lot of middle class folks, definitely upper class, could live their whole life without encountering, in terms of sitting down having a cup of coffee,
right,
with somebody who's homeless. I mean, I think that's changing. It really is. I'm hearing more and more stories where, you know, my uncle's homeless, my son is homeless, things are changing. But but I think the boundaries still exist in some communities where, you know, that's a problem. We go out and the way we try to address that in our own little way is we go preach everywhere and talk everywhere that we're invited, in Maine anyway. And
well, it's interesting because the car culture of commuters or people, you know, really can create a very guarded existence and much more than we realize.
Right.
It's beyond convenience. It's actually
right. Kind
of separate.
It can be. And it also, even with people who are walking downtown Portland, you know, they've come out for their lunch sandwich, you know, and they're walking past people that are homeless. I mean, we talk a lot about what would it take to to stop for a minute, you know, and find out a little bit about how that person's day is going. And one time I was preaching in a small little town, and they were saying to me, basically they were saying, you know, there's no problem really here. I mean, we take care of our own. And as I was listening to this on my other side, I heard this whispering going on between two women, and one was saying, well, you know, did you ever find out who those people were that ride that bicycle into the woods? And I stopped, you know, the conversation. I said, I'm really interested in this. Could you please speak out loud what you're talking about? And it seems like there was this couple who were riding a bicycle in the middle of winter and would get off the highway or the main drag and ride the bike into the woods. So I said, does anybody in this room know who they are? You know, and nobody's hand went up. And I said, does anybody know why they're going into the woods? And nobody's hand went up. And I said, you know, it'd be really interesting to find that out. And I thought it was a perfect example of they all knew this couple. They all had seen them, you know. But what happens to all of us, and it certainly happened to me in my life, I've passed plenty. I'm from New York. I've passed plenty of homeless people without talking to them. It's our patterns, our routines. We get in into not seeing, you know, not feeling. But anyway, that was a perfect example of here was this person, these two people. Obviously, they were in dire straits. Who lives in the woods in the wintertime riding a bicycle, you know, and without a story anyway, that is probably challenging. So all of us pass by, and sometimes we have to, that's for sure. We can't be open to the suffering of everyone. I think we'd probably all go mad. But there's definitely more we can all do, I think, to be awake to people suffering.
Yes, and we see it happening right in front of us, and everything's very habitual. We go along our path.
Yeah.
Now again, these are some real boundaries. Share with us what might be some imagined boundaries.
Well, most of the time, it's that they're frightening. The people that are different than us, or people that we haven't grown up with, or people that look different, are frightening. I can't tell you how many times somebody has said to me, "I want to walk with you, but I'm scared." Or I want to walk with you, but I had an alcoholic, a rageful alcoholic in my history, and I'm scared. Can you stay with me? Will you stay with me? You know, and when we walk, and I, of course I will. But usually, I mean, I can say probably totally that at the end of the experience, people are talking about people by their first name.
Yeah.
And they're saying to me, well, where is George going to sleep tonight? Or what do you mean, Al is this or that, or has gotten thrown out? Or, you know, it's so interesting to me how, you know, what was scary is the unknown or our past associations.
Yeah.
You know? And that isn't to say that people on the street sometimes can't be scary. That's not realistic.
Right.
But in general, the imagined boundaries that I see are the judgments that people are going to get hurt, that I'm going to get hurt, you know.
Right.
And
something unexpected, something violent might happen.
Yeah, mostly violent. And, you know, I've known people to say, I won't even drive in that part of town. I don't want my car to get damaged.
Oh.
You know.
Yeah.
And then once they walk or they spend an afternoon with people, then it's like, well, I'm driving over there because I haven't seen Winnie in a long time. Is she still all right? So that what was like a part of town where they didn't want to go, now they're driving through to find out how the person is that they had met.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, it brings to mind so many things, first of all. But there's the story of, you know, Francis of Assisi and basically the big turnaround day for him, which had to do with the leper. And that perception, you know, of like these people you need to stay very clear from with a whole lot of fear.
Yeah.
And then once he crossed that boundary one day to make that relationship, the rest of his life, you know, moved right along. It's the fear, the fear of the stranger.
Well, I think that's to me, that's great spiritual work. I mean, that we're up to is watching what we're afraid of and, you know, for some reason, I haven't been physically afraid in general. Maybe one time there was some strangeness happening.
Well, you're from New York, you said.
Yeah, that's probably helps, you know.
Yeah.
But I have fear. I try to tell people, and they say, you know, I'm afraid of alcoholics, or I'm afraid of this or that. You know,
yeah.
Well, I'm not particularly afraid of that, but I've been very afraid of being ridiculed, you know, and made fun of, you know. And yes, it happens, but it's kind of like, well, yeah.
By whom?
Excuse me?
Ridiculed by whom?
Oh, by people. Oh, of course. Yeah.
By your peers?
Well,
or by the folks you're...
Christianity doesn't have a good rep.
Or both.
What, no, I didn't hear you. What'd you say?
By your peers or the folks you're trying to minister to, or both?
Well, maybe both. But what I was thinking of is, no, when we started, Christianity doesn't have a good rep. It's had a lot of strings attached to its outreach a lot of times.
Yeah.
And so when we started, we had a lot of judgment put on us. I mean, people didn't know who we were personally. And there was a lot of judgment of, well, what are you out here for?
Try to convert folks, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you want from me? Where do you want me to go? What do you want me to say? You know?
Yeah.
And it took quite a few months for people to finally say, oh, wait a minute, I get it. You don't want anything from me. So people would, and then also if people are not on their meds, they can be outrageous,
Yeah.
And so my fear was more like, oh my gosh, I was kind of a closet prayer. Even as a minister, I'd like to pray quietly. So when you're out there, sometimes you have to pray out loud with people. They'll ask for it.
Yeah.
And I it stretched me. I thought, oh, I don't want to be labeled as a real Bible thumping crazy person, But anyway, what I was trying to get back to the fear is, but that to me is where our spiritual growth is. I don't know, it seems to have worked.
Getting outside the comfort zone.
Yeah, and finding out what we're afraid of.
Yeah.
So it seems like if you're afraid of alcoholics, then take a look at that a little bit.
Yeah.
And definitely if you work, at a soup kitchen or someplace where there are a lot of chronic alcoholics, you're going to look at it. You're going to have the chance anyway.
Mm. Well, it's interesting because what church has become, is very ornate and regular and scheduled and, a particular building mm-hmm. for an hour on a particular day.
Mm-hmm.
But in the beginning, if we go back to the beginning, Jesus, I think, just said, you take a pair of shoes and a jacket and start walking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically where it started, which seems to be where your ministry is. Now, are you finding, because besides the fear of some folks that might be struggling with some mental issues, are you finding that purely because of circumstance that there is any kind of increased number of homeless in the city?
Yeah, well, I think it seems to me anyway, and I don't have the figures, but the shelters seem to be overflowing. But that seems to have been like for the past year or two. It doesn't seem dramatically different in the last few months or anything. So there's always an overflow. The men's shelter in Portland is at least 150 men on pads on the floor mainly and cots every night, and they have an overflow too. And the women's shelter has an overflow. And so I see that, and I see the lines for the soup kitchen extending more to families with young children.
Yeah.
It seems like they're taking advantage of the. We have a wonderful soup kitchen in Portland. And three meals a day, every day. And so I see more families doing that, taking advantage of the food and the meals. So I don't know what the statistics are because it's always seemed pretty busy to me since we've only been out a little over 6 years. So I don't see a dramatic change in 6 years. It's been busy since we started.
Mm. Thank you. Now, I found on your website a profound comment about your ministry, which is that it is at times as simple as sharing a cup of coffee,
mm-hmm.
Like in a Dunkin' Donuts, or finding someone a used bicycle
mm-hmm.
to make getting about easier. It can also be as psychologically and theologically complex as being with people who have been beaten and discarded and are sure that God does not exist in the reality of their suffering.
Mm. Yeah.
That's a very impactful statement. So if you are helping people to remember the sacred in the midst of this suffering, can you share how do we relieve the suffering? How do you offer hope?
Mm. Yeah, I have a co-pastor, Elizabeth, and we talk about this a lot. The suffering's big. Sometimes it feels like you're standing in a stream, but most of the time it feels like you're in a river, and it's just pushing, how the river pushes against the body, when you're standing in it. And it's big, and we can't, certainly can't eradicate it. You know, it's part of this reality. But I know over and over again there have been moments where the contact, you know, the authentic contact with someone, you know, it's been said so many times we need each other.
Yeah.
But it's so true. I mean, there's just, there's been moments just where I can't always even explain what transpires. One day there was somebody I knew really well, and well, I don't know really well. I knew her. And she was standing on the curb, and she was wearing see-through pants. And I don't think things were going down too well with see-through pants on, you know. So and so I was going to walk by because I thought, you know, she didn't look at me. She knew me, but she was looking away. So I thought, well, this is maybe not a good time. I don't know what she's up to here. And but something made me, I don't know. I turned around. I went over, spoke her name, and I just put my hand, I think I'm just on her arm a little. And we just chatted for a moment just about how things going.
Mm.
And I was about to leave, and just something, I just couldn't resist. It happens sometimes, and I hope it's okay. I don't know what, if it's really a deeper wisdom or if it's my ego, who knows sometimes. But I said, you know, I really see you. And she turned and, like, got kind of like eye to eye, you know.
Yeah.
And I said it again. I said, I really see who you are. And the two of us just started crying. And it was just a sacred moment. That's what it was. Not planned, you know, not particularly in depth in terms of what we said to each other. And I just left her, you know. But those kind of things happen all the time, you know. And they happen mutually to me. I'll be walking along in a kind of stupor, you know. And this guy who's I know now a few years on the street, and he's just a walking saint. Talk about St. Francis, this guy probably reincarnated. But he's just fantastic, and he's dealt with cancer and all sorts of things, and he's on the street. And, you know, he came up one day. I was like just kind of moving along. I don't know what I was thinking even. And he said, you know, he's guiding my steps today, Pastor Mir. I can feel it. Mm. And it just snapped me up. It was like, oh, my God, the faith this guy has.
Mm.
You know, he's got so many problems and so many things going on, and in and out of hospital, and he's homeless, and he reminds me. He reminds me of what it's like to have that kind of faith, because at that moment I didn't have it. I wasn't feeling it. So it's I don't know. I don't know if that answers your question, but I think if you and this is true. You don't have to be working with the homeless. I think if you try to be authentically yourself and show up with whoever you want to show up with and have some kind of interest in them, something sacred happens.
Yes. Yes. Thank you for that. That's true. Mm. In any circumstance.
Mm.
To be your authentic self.
Yeah.
And it seems to me with the folks you are encountering in some way, they are examples of just a really raw experience of being human. Mm. And very stripped away.
Yeah.
Very vulnerable. But you have a mutual relationship.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't, you know, I don't profess that I've been homeless or, you know, I have an apartment. Thank God I have an apartment. I come into this little apartment and I'm like, oh, thank God I have a fridge. Thank God I have a bathroom. I feel very grateful.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, about the impact of your work, it can bolster people, but can you share about the impact of your work on them?
Yeah.
Is it, do you see them through this time? Please share about how this works.
Right. Yeah. Well, I have to admit, most of the time we don't know about our impact. I mean, there's a lot of people we never see again. We don't know, or we see them for a very, like a month or two, and then we don't know where they are.
Mm.
So we don't know about that. There are people we do know over time, and some of them have become housed, and we stay connected to them. Some of them we do, and some of them we don't. We can't extend our circle to people that are housed too much because we just don't have that much time to
right.
do that. But some of them we have stayed in their life, and there's somebody I know that I meet every 6 weeks or so, and we go out for lunch, and I met her on the street with her pit bull, and she scared the daylights out of me. But one of her comments when I said that was, you can't judge a book by its cover, Pastor May.
Right.
Which I thought was really funny because she really is a sweetie. But so I don't know. I think I don't know, Pastor Elizabeth and myself. We've said this. I think we're at our best when we don't have an agenda, when we don't know if we're going to help anybody, so to speak, or whether we're going to get them in treatment because we've talked to them. Or, you know, some people, I'm not saying this works for everybody, you know, and there are plenty of people that need to be in treatment, that's for sure. And but we meet a lot of people who are not ready for treatment, or when we ask if we want to be driven somewhere, they don't want to go, you know.
Right.
So I don't know. I think we're at our best when we show up and we care about or are curious about who we're talking to. And we listen as deeply as we can to see if there's some way we can bring some hope. And we bring it in, and we don't even know if it's hope, actually, but we do odd things. You know, if somebody's worried about, you know, their kids are living in far away and they're with another relative, sometimes we get toys for that person and help them wrap a package and get it in the mail, you know, as a contact,
because
they haven't seen their kids in a long time. We do all sorts of little things that would be pretty hard for people to do on their own.
Very supportive.
Yeah.
Those little things make all the difference.
I mean, it's little things.
That's right. Now, I remember having a conversation with a homeless gentleman where I was in college, and I was reading a textbook on astronomy, and he said to me, next to me, he asked me what I was reading, and I told him astronomy, and he says, "Oh, isn't that where we take our entrails and map them on the stars?"
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's gastronomy, but the completely different viewpoint was startling, and from where he was. Now, is it important that the folks you are ministering to, that they believe in God, or is it more of an open encounter that's based on support and compassion?
Mm. Well, since we don't know what God is, and, you know, I think we don't, I don't worry too much about that. I don't care if people, and I know Pastor Elizabeth feels the same. I don't think, even though we're an outreach of the United Church of Christ, I mean, we are a Christian outreach ministry, but we don't really care about what people believe. It's not something we talk about unless they want to talk about it. And I've had some really profound, I think, for me anyway, conversations with people, and our theology, if you wanted to say that, would be very different, you know. But people need to talk about their... the one fellow was telling me about how he used to stand on top of a building, and he did it for a few years, and he was trying to kill himself. And he would stand on this building. He got away up at it, and onto the roof at night. And there was a fence on the building, so he'd hold onto the fence and slip over the side of the building, literally, with the front of his feet, but hold on with his heels. And he did this swinging, like, gently back and forth on the fence. And he really was building up to jump. And then he would say, and he told me once, this isn't somebody who goes to church or anything. He said, "What happened?" He said, "Pastor Mears, one night I got filled, my chest," he said, "got filled with something." He said, "I think it was God." And he said, "I got so clear that this was the wrong thing to do and that it would hurt people. And I've never done it again." I mean, to me, that was a God experience. I didn't have any debate about that. He didn't need to have theology. In fact, it gets in the way, I think, a lot of times. So, I mean, with those kind of conversations that he shared with me, I felt really privileged that he could share that with me, you know, and talk about that. And, in fact, we've used it sometimes when he still gets down, you know, to go back to it and say, you know, what was that? And is it still with you? You know, do you think it's still with you?
Yeah.
So,
touched by that sense of well-being, touched by an angel.
Presence. Something is with him.
Yes. Thank you, Mayor. You are listening to the Godspeed Institute live on the Progressive Radio Network. We're about halfway through the program, And we're going to take a musical break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation on ministering to the homeless with street pastor Reverend Mayor Honan. Let's spend a couple of minutes now with the Doobie Brothers. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute, and that was Taking It to the Streets. You are live with CARE, and we're talking about ministering to the homeless with street pastor Reverend Mayor Honan. Mayor, let's touch base about your journey in this part of the show. What drew you to the ministry and to this ministry?
I think it was a process of kind of elimination in some ways. I was in the seminary. I had gone later in life to the seminary. And when you're in the seminary, I don't know about everybody's experience, but mine was as you move along, people get into what church they're going to be ministering,
right.
You know, and where they're going to get their church. And I absolutely knew that wasn't for me. I just knew that that it wasn't going to work well, and that I don't think my skills are... just would have been a good fit. And yet that leaves, well, why have I done this, and what have I spent all this money on except for my own personal growth, you know?
Right.
And at the same time, I had someone say, why don't you connect with this woman, Debbie Wyman, and she is an Episcopal priest, and she, I guess around 15, 18 years ago now, she started a ministry to the homeless in Boston, which has gotten... pretty large now. Common Cathedral Ecclesia Ministries, and but she started just by simply, when she got ordained, you know, putting a backpack on with sandwiches and starting to walk around, which at that time was not done. You know, people didn't just do that. You know, and so I went down. I didn't really work with her; I worked with another minister, and it was just profound. I mean, I just felt like, oh my God, you know, this is the work I'm supposed to do. I think and. How am I supposed to do this, you know, and where am I supposed to do it? I'm living way up the coast in Maine, and, you know, it was like, oh, God. But the last day I was there, there was a guy sleeping on the bench in the park. In Boston, people do that more than here, I think. And anyway, he was sleeping there, and I was by myself, and he sat up, and he said, so you're back, you know, and I started arguing with him, which is crazy. But it was like, no, I've never been here before. I don't. But somebody else, you know. And he had something to tell me, and I finally shut up and just listened. And he said, "Yeah, I nearly went with you yesterday when you were here." He said, He said, I nearly went to your church, he said, but when I got up, you said to me, the reason I was lying on this bench was because I was a sinner. And somehow that moment for me, it just, I don't know, it just like coalesced in a way that was total surety that I was supposed to do the work, but not with that message. And I knew I was going to do the work. It was just so totally clear. So very shortly afterwards, I met somebody who wanted to do the work too, and I moved to Portland, and we started wandering around and finding out, well, how could we do this, and how could we, if we could be helpful, what would it look like? And I didn't realize, you know, when you step out into anything, you minimize sometimes how it's all about yourself. You know, you think it's going to be, you're going to do a project to help other people. And it really has been, selfishly, it's been the best spiritual path I've ever, and I've purposely tried a few in my life, but it's the best spiritual path I've ever discovered.
Thank you, Mayor. What kind of previous paths have you explored?
Well, as I said, I'm an ordained minister, so I try to follow Jesus as best as I can figure out what he would be up to or how or what he was up to. I'm also a Buddhist. I've joined Thich Nhat Hanh's order about 18 years ago, I guess now. And so the Buddhist practice had been real helpful to me in terms of trying to spiritually grow. So I dabbled in other hats also years ago. The reality of being with people who will call you out on things,
yep.
who can smell the hypocrisy in my speech if I have it.
Yep, 10 yards away.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
That's just one of the ways it's wonderful.
Yes, no, I can understand that. It's very much alive.
Yeah.
And honest.
Yes, it's right. That doesn't mean everybody on the street is honest. But,
right.
But there is this pull to be able to be. If someone is addicted, I can even say that to most people now.
Yeah.
I can say I'm real worried about you. You're down the rabbit hole, and I don't know what to do. You know, and even at that level, people can they'll come over and they'll hug me and they'll be high as a kite and they'll say, "Don't worry about me, Pastor Weir." You know, and there's a certain authenticity that passes between us. It's selfishly, it's wonderful for me.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, I imagine folks in the city can relate to being asked for money a lot.
Yes,
which happens. And I remember years ago, you know, always being asked.
I know.
For money, and I turned to someone, you know, and I said, "What do you want it for?"
Yeah,
and she said, "What?" I said, "What do you want it for?"
Yeah.
And she goes, "Food." I said, "Really?"
Yeah.
And she goes, "Yeah." So I said, "Well, come on, I'll buy you a sandwich."
Right.
So we sat down together and had a sandwich.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
You know, folks are worried, what is my money going for?
Right. You followed your instinct on that.
You just, you know, you can try to cross a little barrier there.
Yes.
You know, because
yes.
These folks are people, and especially in these times. I mean, there are things overlapping right now between, you know, the homeless and the Occupy movements
yeah.
out there.
Yeah.
You know, it's a really tough time. And there are articles every day in the papers about, you know, just families, regular families and the
right.
foreclosures. And,
right.
you know, it's a real issue with, you know, like you said, people who are basically your extended family.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
So you have your tools, you're a minister of the United Church of Christ, and you have your, you know, Buddhist practices, which are very helpful. Is that basically the preparation for this work, and the rest is basically like a baptism by fire?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. I think you'd have to feel comfortable with some differences. I mean, you know, I think that would be helpful. I think everybody has their comfort levels of who they want to talk to, who they not want to maybe, but who they have talked to in their life. And I'm a psych nurse too, so I mean, I can say that I guess there's been some pieces in the puzzle here of my life that have helped me feel more comfortable maybe. But I don't know if you need very much except some honesty and some caring. And I do think you do need, because we've had, some people come forth and they've had their own mental health issues. I do think you need to be in some kind of, if you're dealing with mental health issues, you need to be in treatment yourself. You know, you need to be balanced somewhat.
Yeah.
Because there are many people on the street who are not. And
yeah.
I don't think it's helpful if you're not taking care of yourself. You know, I mean, we're always telling each other that, take care of yourself, take care of yourself. But I really see that that there's, you know, the whole problem and challenge about spiritual emergence and mental health issues. I mean, you could talk a week on that one. But
right.
But I do think that, yeah, that the folks who are dealing with a lot of challenges of addiction and drinking and mental health issues, I don't think they need another person out there doing good, supposedly doing good, and not kind of taking care of who they are or why they're even there.
Right. That's a good question about motive.
Yeah. Right. Why are we doing it?
Huh. Now, what are some of the personal challenges that you might face in this ministry each day? You mentioned in the last part of the show that sometimes you need some hope yourself.
Right.
What do you encounter?
Yeah. Well, sometimes you cry a lot, and that's so it's sad. It's really sad at times. We just helped officiate on 6 memorials in the course of, I guess, the past 2 months.
Really?
There's a lot of deaths. And I think that's there are, you know, places, I guess, ministries that do have a lot of deaths in their work. But there's more deaths than, say, in a traditional parish. And they're harsh deaths. I mean, there's no fun dying of alcoholism and drugs.
On the street.
Yeah, it's no fun. And, I mean, the path up to that is no fun. So that one of the hard things is, you know, I don't think I could do this if I was single and living alone. I have a little family unit, and they're a funny bunch, and we laugh a lot and do silly things and watch crazy movies. And I have a big old dog that's ridiculous. And so I think you need some balance. If anybody who's dealing with suffering hopefully has some balance in their life, or else I think you'd end up probably resenting the people that you're with. You probably want them to get better faster.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I have had moments like that, but in general, I don't feel that way, you know, that you should get better for me, you know, because I'm suffering, because you're sick, you know. But I think that taking care of your own sadness and your own feelings of powerlessness, you know, I think are really important when you're dealing with people that are suffering a lot.
Mm. And that's a powerful witness that you offer, too, to, you know, people who are so much on the cusp, you know, on the edge of life.
Yeah.
You know, and death. Last summer you taught a class, Sacred on the Street, in which students walked with you several times over the summer. What did you hope that they would learn or gain or be able to perhaps apply?
Well, I figured the people that registered for it would already be interested in poverty issues and interested in, and they were. I mean, that's what they talked about, you know, that they wanted to get a little deeper into knowing, well, what was really going on and who were the people? Why were they homeless, you know, and who were they? You know, so they did find that out. You know, even in just a month's class, you can find that out. You know, so I think, you know, that they, in general, were people who were more curious. You know, they put their money and their time into it to hang out and find out who was there. You know, I felt like saying to them, you know, you really could do this on your own. You didn't have to pay anything.
Yeah, I know. You don't need to get the class credit for going out to talk to people.
Huh?
To go out to talk to people.
Yeah, right.
Right?
But it's also nice to have, you know, a comrade with that. So, and we did learn, we did read some things together and learn a little bit and have some real good conversations on it, about our own judgments. You know, about our own judgments.
Yeah.
A lot of
them. And that's so much of it, and they can feel safe, you know, together.
Yeah.
I also want to mention, while we're here, about the folks that you mentioned, you know, living out in the woods.
Yes.
That Gary Knoll has a film on the veterans, very many American vets who are homeless and also living out in the woods.
Mm.
And you can find info about that on PRN.org.
FM. I wanted to ask you, do you think your ministry needs to expand?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. Of course, I guess we could. Last year we had about 3,000 contacts and about 1,000 relationships. But to me, relationships are where we actually help somebody. We had a conversation. We got to know them a bit.
Do you mean 3,000 contacts who
are
homeless?
Like, yeah.
Now, Portland's a city with about 60,000 people.
Yeah.
That's a big percentage.
Right.
Isn't it?
Well, that means that we went out and we contacted within that day, say, 35 people, you know, that's not hard to do when you're in and out of shelters, contact. But context doesn't mean you formed much of a relationship. It just means you've walked by somebody and said hello or just waved at them.
Yeah.
So we've started to keep, my co-pastors made me realize it's people actually ask us these questions of how many people do we see and stuff. So I never used to keep count. Now she's keeping count. And that's where I got these numbers for last year. But should we see more people? I don't know. Should there be more of us walking around? I don't know. There are places we don't go. We haven't been able to do much work, say, if they would allow us in the family shelter. So I guess we could use more of us. They probably could use another pastor, and that would mean more money for a pastor because we both get a small salary. But I'm not sure. I mean, I don't know what our expanding would be. And maybe that's because, you know, do the people who start something, are they the expanders, or do we need somebody coming on board now with ideas that I don't have, you know?
Yeah.
That's a thought I've been thinking lately is, you know, I helped form something, and so kind of it's not in its toddler, maybe it's in its, I don't know, preschool phase now or something.
Yeah,
and maybe I'm not the person to have the ideas of how we should expand, because I really don't have them.
Yeah.
I mean, somebody asked me this the other day, so where are you going with this? And I said, you know, I haven't the foggiest.
I don't know.
Spirit hasn't told me anything about that, so I don't know where I'm going. I'm just doing it, you know, I'm doing what I'm doing.
Right. Well, you know, that's basically, I mean, if we head over to someone like Mother Teresa, that's all she did.
Just
she took care of people her whole life.
Yeah, right.
And I'm sure there are a lot of folks saying, but when are you going to change something?
Yeah.
And
well,
her response is, you know, this is my ministry.
Right.
To take
and
care.
I totally get that there needs to be work in Augusta, and there needs to be work on a level of, you know, of looking at macro issues around poverty, you know, and political issues around poverty. Our ministry isn't doing that. It isn't presently doing that. I don't mean it couldn't, because we do have a lot of contacts, you know, now. Should we be helping these folks? There is a Voices for the Homeless in Portland. There's already a lot going on in Portland. And those are people who were homeless in general, and they do go and do political outreach up in Augusta.
Yeah.
But we're not doing that.
Right. No, you're very specific.
Yeah.
In what you offer and support.
At this point, that's right.
And now this, of course, being a national issue, homelessness and the stress of the economy and such, I want to just ask you from, you know, your own personal place of your own heart, what do we need to change in ourselves to get to a place where people don't find themselves in this situation?
Yeah. Oh, boy. I think greed, to me, is such an issue. You know, to me, all of it is a spiritual issue.
Yes, it is.
Because if we're hungry, we're all hungry. Now, how do we get hungry? We feed ourselves with different things. Some of us feed ourselves, you know, with things and needing more and wanting more. And I think the hunger is really for the divine, and I think it gets misplaced in a lot of us, and we do all sorts of things to fill it. But so to me, it's all a transformational issue around our spiritual life and about our spiritual level of spiritual reality with us. Because if you change that, these people are your brothers and sisters. And you will remember them. And you won't say, oh, my God, I better put another 50,000 in the bank when, you know, they're down there with no bed.
Right.
It just doesn't happen that way. So I think, I don't know, and politically, I don't know, that you can't even get to that to me.
Right.
Because that isn't where it's ever really been changed. I mean, you can make laws, but the actual reality of greed and what it is and the ignorance that is surrounding greed, you know, that is why we have the homeless. I mean, that's they can figure out, okay, the economy is this, the economy is that. But if there was a real ability for all of us to awaken to our spiritual life and to the spiritual truths that I believe, anyway, have us as one, and how can we do that? Well, I don't know. There's been people that have come before me that are totally much more,
yeah,
you know, enlightened on how, and we're still struggling along. But I know that in my tiny little time, at least I can aim in that direction with my life. You know?
Yeah.
And with this little ministry, I think we're aiming in that direction. We're treating people, I believe we are anyway, and I hope that they would call me on it if I'm not. We're treating them with respect. You know, and we're saying, yeah, you're in dire straits. I can see you got your sneakers are wrapped with duct tape today. This stinks, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe I can get you a new pair of sneakers by Tuesday, but I'm also talking to you like you're my brother. And so that's a good thing.
Mm.
I think that's a good thing.
In many ways, you're the outward sign, the visible sign of what things could be.
Yeah, well,
and your needs are being met, but your priorities are different. You know, different.
Mm.
And when we look at the structures of society and we see, as you mentioned several times, the greed,
yeah,
and the lack of balance and the lack of compassion that comes from that,
yeah,
and realizing these are our brothers, you know, our,
yeah,
our and sisters.
Yep.
You mentioned Boston. Are there other places you're aware of or you work with?
Oh yeah,
in the area.
Yeah, not just in the area. There's a network of ministries to homeless all across America, and we're on their list. I mean, when we get, you know, when messages pass around. But in Boston, it's Common Cathedral. They meet. They have their service right in the Commons. I forget,
yeah,
which corner that is, but anyway, every Sunday morning, and they have their outreach going too. And, you know, I know of other ministries in New York, and I know of one in Newburgh. They're all,
oh, yeah,
over the place.
Everywhere.
There's more people, really, who are, you know, I don't know, more people. There are a lot of people who are stepping out into the street and saying, you know, maybe people out here need some help. Instead of, if they come to us and sound like us, we'll help them. You know,
right.
I think that time is finished. I hope it's
So to all the spiritual communities out there and the churches gathering each week and such, do you have a comment to them before we close? The comment on compassion,
mm-hmm,
and offering hope as the way forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I would say, oh, God, the same thing that I think so many people said, Merton, so many people, just listen. You know, really, all of us, if we have any desire for change to happen, you know, for good to happen, which I think most people do, unless they're really totally overwhelmed, and it's just to listen, because I totally believe Spirit will work with you to find out what you're supposed to do next. And it may be something that you can't even imagine at this moment, but it may be just something you do, you know, in your own home that you really kind of hadn't thought of doing. So I just think, first, the listening is so important, because we're not alone.
Mm, thank you. And then start the conversation about what might be able to do getting outside our door.
Yeah.
You know. Mayor, as we come to the end of the program, I wanted to let listeners know that your website info and contact information will be posted on our homepage shortly at GodspeedInstitute.com. I want to thank you so much for being on the program.
Yeah, well, thank you. This has been interesting and hopefully does a bit of good. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure it will.
Yeah.
And, you know, please stay in touch.
Okay.
Let us know how you're doing.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thanks, Ka.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye. And listeners, before we close out the show, along these lines, I just want to share with you CARE's tip for your spiritual tool belt that we wrap around ourselves each day. And it's just a little reminder about the buddy system. When my daughter and I used to go out in town when she was little, we remembered stepping aside on the sidewalk in the village to let the kindergarten class pass us, and they passed us two by two. The buddy system, I recalled with a smile. children stay connected without question, without hesitation, during their daily walk along Main Street. Hold hands, their teacher would call, and they did, happily. The children didn't know distance. They didn't know yet separation from their peers. They didn't question the type of person their partner was. They had no self-conscious regard, no burden, no judgment, no distance. The buddy system is harder to maintain as we grow older, in our adult life, as we work for ourselves, in our own families, in our own cars, in our own house, on our own street, in our own neighborhood. It can become difficult to remember that the other person remains our friend. And yet we know that the buddy system works decade after decade. Thank you for joining us for the Godspeed Institute today. This program was recorded live on the Progressive Radio Network in New York City and produced by Michael Hallenbeck. Our guest was Reverend Mayor Honan. The Godspeed Institute is an independent educational organization dedicated to promoting religious tolerance and celebrating the value of spiritually based living. If you would like to hear this or any of our previous programs again, or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. Please send your comments to office@GodspeedInstitute.com. We always enjoy hearing from you. And join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Until then, we wish you Godspeed on your journey.